Welcome to the Geopolitical Ecology Podcast, where you will find critical conversations at the intersections of nature, culture, and power.
In this episode, we sit with Sophie Van Nest and discuss the politics of climate adaptation, or how urban landscapes are changing as a result of a warming planet. First, set in the neighborhood of Lachine, Montreal, we highlight tensions between approaches from governments and planners, aka people quote-unquote in power, versus how community groups organize around the issues most directly affecting them. Here we see the importance of highlighting historical uneven development across neighborhoods, as neighborhoods with less investment are hit the hardest by the climate, and yet quote-unquote climate adaptation plans rarely take this into account. In relation to that, we touch on spaces of resistance and the incorporations of tactics such as blowing up pipelines into the climate movement, in conversation with more quote-unquote academic approaches that give institutional legitimacy to these movements. Through all of this, we are musing on climate justice as a framework for coalition building towards a more sustainable and equitable world. Sophie helps us ground these insights through her critical research. Sophie L. Van Nest is an associate professor in urban studies at INRS in Trocadéro, Montreal, holder of a Canada Research Chair in Urban Climate Action. She has two strands of research in urban environmental politics. One is on social movements and citizen initiatives from an urban studies and infrastructural perspective. She has recently published on urban mobilizations against pipelines. Her second strand of activity is participatory action research for justice and climate adaptation. She is currently working on two projects during her sabbatical year. First, she is building new relations and comparative insights on the themes of just climate adaptation in the city and the home, especially in relation to extreme heat. Her second project is on social movements for climate justice, comparing mobilization building efforts in Quebec, BC, and two regions in France. I am joined by my co-host friend and comrade Yusuf, and here is our conversation with Sophie Van Nest. Hi, Sophie. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for agreeing to join us. It's a real pleasure to be able to chat with you in this way. And also, I know we met a few weeks ago in a political ecology seminar with Rafi at UBC. And I'm happy to introduce you to Yusuf, who's my co-host and comrade, and have him take it away.
Hello, Sophie. It's nice to meet you. I've heard a lot of good things from Erica about your research. And I had the chance to also look up a few of the papers you've written and see, look into some of the things you've been working on. But of course, to build a bridge with our listeners, I'd like to maybe first start by asking you if you could give us a brief history of how you ended up thinking, reading, and writing about urban uneven development, climate adaptation, and social movements, and what motivated you to undertake this kind of research.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really happy, glad to be part of these conversations. This is great. So I started being really interested actually from my PhD thesis about social movements as agents of change. I think this is how we change the world. But on the scene of climate change and infrastructure politics, I became more and more interested about issues of uneven development and inequity, because these connections and relations are always full of tensions, and they don't make their place in the political debates enough, right? We don't even talk enough about uneven development, even though it's in your face, in my opinion. So I think it became more and more obvious to me that we should talk much more about bring in the climate change conversation issues of uneven development, and it sort of became more and more my focus through time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when we say uneven development is in your face, what do we mean exactly by that, and why do you think it's kind of left out of that discussion?
Good point. Maybe I'll give one example, which we'll talk a little further later. For example, climate adaptation policies can be And climate change policies in general can be really transversal and generic, as if everybody's affected the same way. We know this at the international level, that is, of course, completely untrue, but it's also true at the urban level. And it can be really concrete how it manifests itself. For example, in the city of Montreal, we see policies which are not investing where it's the more problematic. For example, you have neighborhoods next to huge infrastructures, people who have difficulty moving around, who don't have access to basic services, who don't have access to housing. And it's not part of the climate policies, even though, of course, it's the main drivers of vulnerabilities to climate change and injustice in the city. So that's what I mean in, like, when you walk in the open fabric, when you speak with community organizers or with people, it's like, it's really obvious how much it's the impacts of climate change are unequal and related to how the city is built and the political economy around urban development. But it doesn't make its way to policies and choices and infrastructures and priorities. And that's really shocking, I think. So that's one concrete example from recent research, but there's a lot of example, you know, of environmental injustice that when you're in the world of community organizing, it's really the level of injustice is really obvious in landscapes. You see it all the time. Yeah,
that really resonates with me, actually. Coming from San Francisco, I feel like just walking around the city, you can see, like, certain neighborhoods are like where wealth versus poverty are concentrated. And I also used to work in homelessness policy, and I saw, like, firsthand how the city just didn't necessarily grapple with that at all in the policy making. So yeah, really appreciate that perspective. Do you think you could speak a little more to your community organizing background and the kinds of experiences you've had that have informed your work before we kind of jump into some of your academic research?
I became involved first personally in sort of more of a green environmental organizer, and then I got more out of this because of how environmental organizing is was framed, at least in the time I started to be involved. But I've been, you know, throughout my work, but more and more when I was in a position, you know, had a university, I've been always, you know, building connection with grassroots and working with grassroots organizer and trying to make it at the center of my research. And this, of course, has a lot of challenges and limits to what I can bring to organizing spaces and social movements. But so I give you example of like in Montreal, we have built this alliance with different neighborhoods of who are sort of like the forgotten neighborhoods of climate policies in Montreal. And we've organized this alliance with grassroots actors and cultural groups, et cetera. So yeah, so that's one example of how I've been involved. I've also been involved in biker organizing in the city. And yes, so I'm trying to make connections between my research and the organizing world and trying to make it useful, let's say. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you for explaining that. And I think we can see the interplays between the community organizing piece and the research piece in your paper that we read a few weeks ago, which is titled Extreme Heat and Uneven Development, Missing Politics in Climate Adaptation. So like I mentioned, we had met in the political ecology seminar where we read this piece. And thank you for letting us discuss it. I know it's still forthcoming. But do you think you can maybe give a little bit of an overview to our listeners about the central oversights that you found in Montreal, specifically in Lachine, which is the research site here, and the kinds of processes you utilize to discover these?
Yeah, so this was really an interesting but challenging research action project. So some of the things we saw and we tried to put more attention to, we see also in other cities. Like the literature review of the article shows that basically the dominant approaches to climate adaptation in city is really either greening to make the temperature go down or emergency response when heat waves are actually happening. But so this sort of brings, there's an immense gap of interventions and priorities around the social drivers of vulnerability to extreme heat, which basically relate to deep inequalities in cities and the legacies of uneven development. So we saw this in the literature. We saw this in Montreal because the attention was to greening and also to sort of technical fixes and infrastructure to make cities more resilient, right? And so our research was really sort of a participatory action research with planners and community local groups. We had workshops and tried to have interactive spaces. We also were in the sort of typical meeting places of planners in the cities and community participatory places. But we saw it was difficult to bring these conversations because of the framing of climate adaptations and the instruments used, and also the relation with development. This was the specific site is in redevelopment projects. So already there's a bias, of course, because the climate adaptation innovation is related to a, you know, redevelopment of an area. But we also saw that this issue of inequity and uneven development was difficult to tackle because of the specific planning instruments they use, because of the story of the past they use to in their planning, and also because of who is which actors are giving more place and more voice. So the tension was that community grassroots organizers are actually doing so much work on these social drivers of vulnerabilities. Of course, they have wonderful projects to make to cope with extreme heat, but also build social infrastructure to make life better in conditions of more and more extreme heat. And they were not really they were not in the dominant conversation. It was difficult to bring their expertise and voices on this around climate adaptation. So basically, that was the, and so we tried to push this further in two ways to show what were the biases of the instruments used by the city planners, and we also did a sort of parallel research, action research with community groups to give more voice and more weight and more lead. You just have more visible their expertise and projects and all the caring practices they are doing in neighborhoods.
I have a quick follow-up on this. I'm just curious in terms of how these tools that you're talking about, these planning tools, how they contrast with social on the ground, like expressions of social infrastructures that could be an alternative, but aren't being the alternative because that is the dominant. Like, what is the dominant pushing for, and what is the alternative pushing for, and how is the alternative kind of taken or not seriously?
Yeah, that's a good question. So two specific instruments were bringing a lot of bias into this. So one is where the money goes, right? It's often one thing. So one is how investment is prioritized. So the money went to resilience, to flash floods, to a lot of, big precipitation events, which are, coming more and more in most cities in North America, and Montreal is one which is very vulnerable to this. But the so this is a lot of money changing the water, the infrastructure, and the urban planning of the neighborhood for this resilience to water hazard. And basically, it's about protecting property from hazards of rain, right? And it's not that it's not important, but it's really targeting all the money onto that hazard. But also, it's even worse because of the second instrument of how the territory of the investment is chosen. So they have to, put a limit on what the space where they're going to intervene and where the money is going to go in these bylaw instruments. And basically, it's the area which is redeveloped, and not sort of a broader perspective. Well, we want to improve the living conditions of all the neighborhoods around, and we know there's going to be gentrification, et cetera. So if you have a bigger perspective of, focusing the investment where the people are most affected by climate hazards, then you will have a much broader investment, territory area. And then, yes, you could change, infrastructure in relation to water, hazards and flash floods, but you would also it if you had the other indicators related to health and inequities, you would also have a much broader territory and speak to, you know, what are the conditions of housing, what is the access to services, like these key components, just like how difficult it is for people to access food in this area, in the agents and neighborhoods, because it's like, I didn't describe it. It's an area with there's a huge highway overpass and interchange. So people on the other side, which actually live close by in terms of distance, have this huge difficulty to cross. There's a lot of accidents, high mortality. Even to access the bus, you have to go to this space, which is really polluted. Conditions of housing are difficult. So accessing just basic services, which is, you know, good quality of life, basic conditions of living, it also helps you cope with heat. It's extremely difficult. So it wasn't targeted in the priorities because of the territories, which were the territory which was limited to the one redevelopment around this eco neighborhood. So these two sort of instruments of choosing investments and choosing the territory, you know, made it biased against this broader prioritization of sectors that are much more in need of interventions and much more affected by the legacies of uneven development. Yeah.
Yeah, and then on the other side of that, I suppose in the parallel research you were doing with community groups, they were more advocating for having a more historical and contextual understanding of the neighborhoods. Is that right? Or were there other practices that kind of emerged from that research that you thought would be helpful to this dominant conversation or in replacing it and such?
Yeah, the local community groups are really talking about the difficulty to access services, to move around, basically, just in the agents and neighborhoods. They were also talking about discrimination, racism, you know, in public interventions, and green gentrification coming up. But it wasn't, even them, they weren't phrasing it in terms of climate adaptations for a lot of reasons later.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the community groups in this case are actually taking more of this like critical or political ecology approach that we discussed compared to the sort of planners in that case. Do you think, I mean, you were mentioning that they're not necessarily seeing their work as climate adaptation. Do you think that they need to be in order for these practices to be kind of united, or is it okay to just let them do as they do and try to highlight them where it's pertinent? Or what do you think is kind of the interplay there?
Yeah, that's a really good and difficult question. So at first, our first instinct was to really present their caring practices and the projects they are undergoing and their practices as part of climate adaptation. And we did that with a report we built with the community roundtable. And but then some actors in the community grassroots organizing scene in Montreal are critical of this perspective because they do fear that they have too much on their shoulders already, and that, you know, having the responsibility of climate adaptation, it shouldn't be all on the shoulders of community groups, if not more resources are given. And so it's difficult. I think it's not of us to resolve, really. It's really the groups that have to sort of see what's more tactically relevant. But at least to bring their expertise in the conversation, I think it's crucial. And then if they want to name it climate adaptation or climate justice or not, I think it's sort of a tactical, like locally, it's something to you know, that they have to choose and negotiate within, you know, their own context. Yeah. And I'm not, you know, researchers are not always the best to judge. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel like it has a bit of a vanguardist connotation of seeing things from above and knowing what's better than the people who actually experience it and live it on a daily basis. I feel like there's a lot of projection that happens from like academia onto the underground dynamics. But it's also, I don't know, I think one of the main purposes of even having this conversation, recording it, posting it on a podcast, having listeners engage, is to kind of say there are spaces that are hidden, where there are signs of uneven development that are kind of in our face, but then sometimes we're not really necessarily looking and we're confined. I mean, it's interesting we're talking about Montreal because I am here right now and I'm in the plateau. I'm not in Lachine and I haven't been to that neighborhood, but I can imagine that it is significantly different than where I am right now. And that, you know, if you have someone visiting from another city and they're staying here, they get a certain image of what maybe the whole city's like, but then you have neighborhoods that are just adjacent that can be radically different. And I know to many people who read about the urban, that is a very obvious thing. But even if it is, I think it's still worth engaging with what creates this uneven development. And then in trying to fix this uneven development or address something like climate adaptation, we kind of inherit the history of uneven development in such a way where the change becomes more difficult or even more difficult to engage with. So yeah, I'm just rambling right now. But I'm just trying to think, like, based on how the conversation has been going so far, the one kind of lingering question in my mind is just when you mentioned the biases and the instruments and thinking about the you know, how the boundaries are drawn in terms of where the resources are going to flow to invest in climate adaptation infrastructure. I mean, kind of making me think, what's the political economy here? Of where's the money coming from? Who's making these investments? Like, with the levels of government in Canada, is it the city? Is it coming from some kind of property tax? And the focus of adaptation on, like, water, for instance, and floods, which obviously is important, but you were saying there are other indicators and stuff that aren't being engaged with, such as housing. I mean, can we talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, totally. There's definitely, and this is something we did succeed in bringing in conversation with planners, and they're really aware of that. And even the political leadership, I think, in Montreal is aware and has it an agenda, but it's difficult to transform. But there's of course, a dependence on fiscal revenues from redevelopment. So it's at the core. So there's like the elephant in the room. That's one thing. Of course, so the redevelopment brings, taxes, and I think it's like one fourth of the population of the borough Lachine, which is it's increasing by one fourth or something with this redevelopment. So it's a huge addition of population and revenue, of course. But there's that, but there's also the money investment politics around. The politics of risk and how cities are accounting for which risk is more to be prioritized versus another. So the water, the risk that flood is bringing to the city is really monetized. There's an accounting of what is the impact in terms of money, right? Because there's already a lot of impact money-wise in terms of reconstructing, but also in terms of the city, inhabitants bringing the city to court because they're flooded, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an accounting around water hazard and flooding, but there's no financial accounting of mortality and health impacts of extreme heat. I mean, there is, but not to the same level of accounting. It's not in the decision process as it is. So it's sad, but it's what we see. And I think that's we could change that. And there's a lot of people that want to change that within the institutional places and outside of it. But right now, this is sort of where we're at. Yeah.
I'm imagining it could be, we can argue that it's like methodologically difficult to have like an accounting for like the risk associated to like the social cost versus saying, oh, this is the damage on infrastructure. Like, it's easy to compute, you know, this bridge cost us this much or whatever to build. Let's just, I'm improvising here. But I'm wondering if it's way more than methodological, like if it's a positionality thing, because these populations are of a lower economic class and I'm assuming racialized, because you mentioned earlier racism was part of the community response, that it's not going, that's what is making, is that what's making it not go into the accounting, is my question.
I think it's part of it. I think it's part of it. It's part of the silos of the city also. And I have to say that there's progress made in that regard since we did that research, and we're continuing the collaborations we have with cities. people in the city also, and they developed actually a new indicator of equity, which are, accounting for all the, some of the things we were talking to them. Well, you're not investing where you need to, right? And it's not like we were the only ones saying that. A lot of people were saying that, but they did develop this new equity, and this they call it the indicator of territory, l'indicateur d'équité territoriale, so territorial equity. So they're like overlapping all these criteria to say, well, now we need to target our core investment there and there. Now there's advantages and limits to that, but it did bring more investments in the specific neighborhood, which we're talking about, the Saint-Pierre neighborhood next to the interchange. Now there's new money, there's resources given to community groups. And so I think we are progressing, at least like publicly in the conversation, you have to take it to account, and new indicators are coming. But I mean, there's limits to, like, we'll see what happens, right? But it is, I think there's efforts, there are efforts being done, and new, as I said, sort of efforts to redirect investments on certain areas. And we'll see how it goes. But it's core issues, like it's not only a new indicator, it's like we're talking about transforming sort of the power imbalances in the cities, the fiscal structure, the political economy of developments, and the dependence of municipalities on this money to even do climate adaptation in the first place. So you're sort of in a weird place, right?
100%. I mean, I think you're speaking exactly to the complexities of what climate adaptation even means in the first place, and whether it's even possible to do climate work, quote, quote, without addressing these other dynamics that are so intertwined with the causes, consequences, and actions in response to climate change, right? And this is exactly kind of, I think, the power imbalances piece is like exactly what's missing from a lot of the mainstream discourses, which, as you highlighted, community groups have always understood because they're the ones living it and facing it. And I think for me, like, it very much resonates. Even I have not lived in Montreal before. I've only been there a few times, but I've grown up in urban environments my whole life, and I do kind of see some parallels in what you're speaking of. And of course, like, as geographers, we think that place matters and locality and context are unique to each place. But I guess I'm wondering, like, to what extent do you think the dynamics you highlighted are sort of unique to Lachine, or do you think there are like lessons here to be taken across cities? Or have you seen even like examples of that happening, where we can form these broader coalitions based on, unique sets of dynamics that can also have connections between them?
Oh yeah, I think it's definitely I think it's relevant to, if not all cities, to most cities. I mean, I think it's really it's becoming part of the conversation in certain cities, and at least in the scholarly conversation, it's you see it more and more. So saying that, we cannot talk about climate adaptation without talking about the unequal legacies of the past. Like, it's just not possible, or it's not relevant if you don't do that. So, and this is it, this has been heard, like, from some of the leaders. I'm talking about work from Vanessa Castan-Brotteaux, which I really like, and she has tried to make this argument in sort of synthesis of the literature. So I think it's coming through. And in terms of practical projects, I don't have one in mind, but I think a lot of cities are going, trying to I think a lot of cities and commu well, cities are trying to bring back history, to have better policies and have memory, but it is often biased. Like, we have to be really attentive to how is history is brought back, and it can be biased in a certain perspective also. So there's a politics also to that, to how we do this memory making and these connections, which. And sometimes we can also, of course, make mistakes on how we do this, as scholars also and researchers, and
I mean, it's interesting because it's making me think of well, I grew up in Beirut. It's basically where I'm from. And just yesterday I was trying to demonstrate to my partner and friend kind of like what the urban looks like there. And so I was just like Why don't I go on Google Earth and just zoom and take a look at it? And it's funny because, like, as a geographer, I've never really done that, but I did. And then I was looking at it and just looking at how much of a mess it is, even though I have no background in kind of like urban planning. I can just tell by looking at an aerial view how certain roads cut through certain areas, how there are many dead ends, how the only official kind of main highway we have goes along the water by the Mediterranean Sea, connecting Beirut to other urbans. And then I was just scrolling, going from Beirut all the way up north, and it's just urban, 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 urban. There's no like in between spaces of just breathing room for so-called nature. I mean, it's, you can argue it's not nature, it's very domesticated, but still. And I don't know, it made me think of our conversation today, because this was just last night, and I was thinking, wow, I mean, if there are these dynamics in very rich countries and the global north, and like settler colonies we're talking about here, right? Cities that are established, that have had a lot of wealth accumulated, if these dynamics exist within these cities, what happens when we talk about like ecological debt and climate debt and wealth and technology transfer from the north to the south, in terms of common but differentiated responsibilities? So I was trying to think of that and like the urban, and I just had no clue how to wrap my head around it, because I've thought about it in terms of, okay, like you can send solar panels and wind turbines, for example, parts of it, and they get assembled in the south or whatever. Like I can kind of imagine that, but the politics of the planning in a way that is equitable and just in terms of climate justice in cities in the south, it's, I don't know if you have thoughts on that, but I'm just like, it's really hard for me to even start thinking somewhere. But I'd love to hear what some of your thoughts on this.
Well, actually, I think some of the most inspiring and for me work on urban politics and climate and urban politics in general, but also climate politics or like urban environmental change is from cities of the South. And it's because in general, scholars have paid much more attention to sort of informal or informality, informal everyday urban governance, like power imbalances and also to everyday practices in cities, sort of collective, the huge contributions of autonomous spaces of collective action, right? Like the social infrastructure, this is there's a lot more work on that and the limits and challenges and tensions of that. But I mean, in cities of the global South and in the global North, where we just sort of assume that. Well, we don't assume, but I mean, I think it's gone much further in showing the interrelations and tensions between informality in state and private and inequalities related to that in relations with autonomous collective action. So basically the conceptualization of social infrastructure in the context of inequalities, I think is better worked in global cities of the global South than what we've done in the global North, and I'm learning a lot from that.
I have one last question before we kind of jump into your work about pipelines that I know we're very excited to ask you about as well, which I think is like something to do with, I guess, the different roles of the different actors that you spoke about. Like we're seeing, of course, you're saying that community groups have this understanding of the uneven development, whereas we're facing these tensions from dominant discourses. And at the same time, like to Yusuf's point, like planners playing a big role in how cities are built and how they're adapted as well. We're gonna talk to a city planner in a couple of weeks, actually, and we'll get her take on this too. But I guess what do you think are like some of the main kind of takeaways or communications you would want to have with planners? And I know you've had some of these conversations before, to try to get them to adapt this kind of perspective of legacy and history and unevenness. And what are some kind of main challenges you've faced in talking to them? And are there ways you see us moving forward with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think when I think back of the process we had in Lachine, I think that I sh we should have started with talking about social infrastructure, like social infrastructure and what and uneven development. Like it wasn't like we talked about, so we came to talk about this, but starting from that and starting from that in what are the potential roles and pushing them a little bit, because and what we noticed is that yeah, it was difficult to see for planners to see their role in terms of social infrastructure, and even though they basically co-build social infrastructure. I mean, in deciding where the services are, or in influencing where the services are, and influencing where how community groups can have their say in where these services are in terms of housing legislation, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, so planners are often, of course, focused on the built environments, but there's a social there are social consequences to the built environments, which I think we have to make more obvious. And this is the same, this is sort of the same issue for climate adaptation. So when talking about climate adaptation, one of the thing I'm trying to do with planners now is to say, well, what are the basic conditions of living and inequities on your territories? And first, that's the first step, and then how climate hazards or you exacerbating that. So it's also about empowering, because a lot of times planners want to do this work. They're just like not accustomed to talk like that or use this vocabulary, or don't know what their role is in that in terms of instruments they're used to. And it's about, yeah, I think you can use this vocabulary and make also it's also about building relations and building collaborations, of course, because it always has to be with local groups that are more experts than planners in that. So it's building true relations. Yeah.
I think maybe now can be a good time to include, not pivot, include, because I feel like they're very connected still, the question of pipelines and infrastructure. So in our very first episode, we had Liam Fox, who is a PhD student at University of Toronto, talk to us about his research on pipelines, and he was focusing on the role of the National Energy Board in approving projects in the name of public and or national interest, so-called, in perpetuating settler colonial violence. So clearly, indigenous communities are the first to bear the brunt of extractivist projects and infrastructure projects across Canada. But of course, it gets muddier and more complex. And as there are other non-indigenous communities in urban peripheries who also at times bear the brunt of such projects. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us about how these spaces, as you write, are rendered invisible in the infrastructure decision-making process and about the challenges of making them visible.
Yes, thank you for the question, and thanks for the connection with this great article from Liam Fox. I'm so glad that there was this piece on the National Energy Board, because this is totally a state institution which is doing a lot of harm, in my opinion, in how it's framing environmental assessment. So yeah, thanks for the connection there. So yeah, I think this is a very interesting questions, and it relates to, you know, there's a lot of great work from political ecology and sort of social and technology studies on this invisibility. And the work I think is interesting in showing how our relations with the living in the non-human world on which we depend to live are sort of made invisible to infrastructure in the city, you know, the infrastructure that make us access water, energy, et cetera, et cetera. So there's great work into that. And of course, it's invisible for people who are privileged to have access and not the people who don't live in sacrifice zone, right? I think the work of making the impacts of infrastructures on lands, lives, waters is crucial, because it shows the actually making these unequal impacts of infrastructure and pipelines in particular visible is what is crucial to make them political, right? To make them in the public debate. They're invisible. Yeah, their invisibility makes it possible to forget them and not consider. Of course, the indigenous resistance to pipeline and oil sand development and fossil fuel complex in general has been really about the impacts of infrastructure and on lands, on their lands, on the relation with beings, with waters, with fish, with their traditional practices, etc. So it's been at the core of their resistance, but it wasn't at the core of non-Indigenous resistance. Like the people we talked to in Quebec and Montreal, we met and we worked with municipalities and grassroots actors. Like it was through the pipeline process that they just sort of discovered. Like pipelines were already there, but it became more and more obvious what were the impacts, the present and future impacts or expected threats on waters, access to water on wooded areas, on agricultural lands and land that they were maintaining and really related to in their everyday landscapes. So making this visible is what made possible the opposition, and it's what made the movement very strong, I think.
And in what ways was that making visible possible? Like how, what are the tactics to make visible?
Yeah, that was very interesting. Well, there were really sort of direct action practices. So people going, so there were specific spots, right? Because so in Montreal area, there were one existing pipelines, the Enbridge Line 9B, which they wanted to reverse the flow and bring oil from the tar sands. And there was another new one to be built. But the existing pipeline was there, right? So people were going to specific spots like manual pumps, which are close to water access, and they were going there and stopping, actually manually stopped the manual pump and seeing what would happen. And it took like, I don't know, 3 days for anything to happen, showing like, okay, there's a problem in this system here. So that's one example, which was showing how, the depth of the problems with the regulations of pipeline in Canada. But they were also making the connections more broadly with water, like making studies of the impacts of water access, like because this would threaten in their studies like up to water access to like 4.1 million people if there was a pipeline failure. They were showing also the connection this had with areas that people had tried to protect for years, like wooded areas, agricultural spaces, of course, indigenous land. But of course, this is something I should have mentioned from the beginning, but the impacts of these infrastructure on the indigenous lands and ways of beings and their practices of protecting the landscape were not heard as much, of course, at all, as much as the other actors. So in our media analysis, the media analysis we conducted, we saw that indigenous communities were given, were their perspective was presented in 10% of the articles we covered. This is the hundreds of articles, right? In 3 years, there was 1,700 articles on pipelines in the Montreal area. It's a ton. And only 10% of them referred to First Nations perspective, and more than 38% referred to municipalities. So the gap in the attention to certain voices more than others was immense. And the depth and quality of the coverage of Indigenous perspective on these interrelations of infrastructure with the land and waters was, just so superficial in comparison to other perspective. So this was obvious. And of course, the depth of the harm done is much, much, much worse on Indigenous communities. So already there's a huge injustice. So that's like the most important, I think, thing we saw. But we also saw that municipalities and grassroots actors did bring attentions to their own relations with the land and waters, which was kind of new in the debate. It was their way to be to have legitimacy to speak in energy politics. They were like, well, we're supposed to protect water, we're supposed to protect also these wooded areas, and actually what you're doing is threatening this without any of our consent. And so they were sort of following in a much more superficial way, I would say, Indigenous leadership and did get media attention because of how our media politics is structured and with its own biases and the colonial world we live in. So yeah, it's the weird politics of they did bring more attention to these relations with the hand and impacts infrastructure has on landscapes, on lands and waters, but without the attention it should have been to indigenous perspectives and so settler colonialism and
Yeah, I mean, it feels like whenever indigenous perspectives, quote quote, of course, like they're not homogenous. It's like there's hundreds of different First Nations are receiving media attention. It's always in this like kind of fetishized way of like, oh, like look at the land defenders, like they're such like better environmentalists than us. And then, the Western institutions start freaking out and think like in their own positivist way, like how can we incorporate this into our like existing optimization scheme or whatever? And it's not really engaging with how folks are practicing these acts. And that also reminds me of like how we even like I think academics often are like, oh, like we need to do climate justice, we need to do climate adaptation, but we're not even necessarily seeing like these, as you put it, like everyday practices are an essential part of that in the first place. I don't know if this is leading to a question. I'm just rambling at this point as well. But I guess like, do you see like a better way in which we can highlight these efforts than the logic that I just described?
Yeah, that's a good question because there was so much during this debate, there was so much enthusiasm, even from grassroots and social movements during the event, were like, oh my God, we'll have a convergence. Even the mayor of the city of Montreal is bringing this issue forward. When you were living it, you were like, yes, we're, and it did succeed in opposing one pipeline, which was sort of, and people were really enthusiastic. And, but then, when it became at some point so apparent that this leadership was controlling the message that was going through the media with the biases it had, then it was, oh, and so in the disappointment around that and the scope of the disappointment around all this radicality and diversity of perspective on our relations to land and everyday practices with the landscapes. Like it was a moment where you had in the article we talk about a messy politics of everyday resistance, and it's because there were so many spaces of like people working to protect the waters, people like envisioning energy completely differently, indigenous practices of connecting, actually learning non-Indigenous people on large scale with the land in certain area region. And there's so many like beautiful relations with landscape. There was also like conservation. Anyways, there were different imaginaries related to how people had practices with the landscapes that were lost and not heard of. So that was a disappointment, and we tried to sort of make some space for that in the article. But I mean, how we to envision this differently? I think it's a big question for social movements, of thinking about the tensions between leadership and collaboration with public authorities, like tactically at certain points of times, versus putting forward the diversity of storylines and the diversity of radical imaginaries that come with social mobilizations. And I think it's sort of a constant tension. And it might relate to the democratic practices within these movements and how to empower that. And yeah.
I think this might be a good segue to our very last question, right, Erica?
Yeah.
So the question is, if do you think climate justice is an effective framework for coalition building across some of the different actors and movements we've discussed? And what do you think critical scholars can do to help advance this movement building?
That's a great question. And we had started talking about it a little bit in the Hafiz seminar with Erica. And it's a difficult question because of some of the issues I talked about before. I try to be really attentive to what are the meanings of the words and terms for people involved in movements and organizers And it can mean climate justice can mean different things, and it can be, it can be appropriated in certain ways, and can be, and sometimes it doesn't always do the political work we hoped it would do, right? So I think in the opposition to fossil fuel, it was pipelines and I think it's going, it has been used, in good ways, and I think it has been successes. And but it does mean, even in Quebec, it meant really different things to different people. And in terms of the urban political scene of what I described in the first part of our conversation, like, climate justice with climate adaptation strategies, I think, some of my colleagues, I have a colleague in Europe who talks about a missing social movement on urban climate adaptation justice, like that the connections between the climate justice movement and community organizing supporting the most vulnerable to climate hazards is not much made. And I agree, but I think there are reasons to that, and we don't want to push that. I mean, it's not for us as critical scholars or scholars in general to push for a certain use of a framework or not. But I do think that our role is to show the limits of climate policies and climate justice frameworks and adaptation policies from the point of view of herd that are, of community injustice and uneven development and marginalized groups. So I would say that our role is more of a translation, sense making, and showing what's not part of the dominant frames. And then if what framework is more strategic or tactic or that makes more sense to the movements, I think it's not really us to judge, but we're there in sport.
Yeah. I also think, kind of going back to, I'm getting like a bit of a flashback to a seminar that Yusuf and I were in together last term, which was the introduction human geography seminar for our program of, what is the role of scholarship or even just research and education in movement building? And I think we kind of came to a similar class consensus of like, we can do some bridge building and coalition building, and kind of, yeah, I guess the translation work, because for better or worse, like academics are given this expertise status by governments and by, broader society. And whether or not that should be the case, I think it's is something that's true, where like planners are more likely to listen to scholars than community groups, and that's fucked up. But with that role, we are able to uplift some of these voices that are traditionally left out of the discourses, and also just help kind of make sense of the situation in a broader level. I don't know, Yusuf, do you agree with that or other thoughts?
I was just going to say, I think it depends which governments and institutions are calling these academics experts, because I think a lot of them are saying, well, academia is hijacked by a bunch of Marxists, and which means it's no longer a legitimate institution, because it's very ideological and dogmatic and not research based, which also I think is like maybe there's a speck of truth in there, but I think it's also bullshit. Like there's a lot of really good research that's done. And I think I'm thinking of an earlier answer by Sophie when discussing the tactics of making visible. The first one was direct action, but then the second and third were studying the impacts and showing the impacts, which requires research. And in a way, like I think if I were to answer this question, it would be along the lines of like, we are given a bit of a privileged position in terms of having the task of accessing information and connecting dots. Like when you are living a reality and not another, you might not have that vantage point to connect these two realities together. So I think that just from that aspect, not from a intellectual superiority vanguardist kind of point of view, but just from positionality point of view and like the access we're given. The institutional access we're given. But otherwise, yeah, I totally agree. And I think in terms of when you were mentioning the seminar, I thought you were going to bring up how to blow up a pipeline.
Oh, we can talk
Not
about that as well. Yeah.
because that's also something I've been thinking about in terms of climate justice. And maybe this could be our last question in terms of like
Yeah.
we've talked a lot about planning and about community visions and futurities, but I've been thinking a lot, especially in terms of keeping up with what's happening in Palestine, if what the role of violence and resistance, and how to build a pipeline. The whole kind of argument is that the climate movement so far, whether it's Extinction Rebellion or Fridays for Future, which yes, he's focusing, Andreas Malm is focusing a lot on like European movements, and even though he mentions indigenous resistance and direct action in on Turtle Island, he doesn't necessarily focus on them. I feel like his audience is not them. It is the European climate movement. And he is saying essentially that the one big missing piece is it's time to normalize violence against objects, right? Especially fossil fuel infrastructure objects. I'm wondering, like, what, I don't know, like, what do you think about that?
I think it's a big question, a big social movement question on the right tactics, and I think that tactic is really is part of what can be game changing. Of course, I think it is, but I think also that the strength, at least in the cases I studied in my research, these types of actions take a lot more meaning and political strength when they're related to. When I talked about these relations with the land and the practices and the spaces of resistance, like when there's meaning into that and what how you relate to land, like what the pipeline that some people would want to blow up, okay? Well, the impact this pipeline has on people's lives and lands and water and sense of safety just life in the world, just life in the world, like the really rich visceral meanings this has for people. I think when you get a sense of that and the imaginaries and in really concrete examples, and then when that's part of the resistance and sort of the communication of what this is about, what the struggle is about, then it's an other level of impact. It's there's different strategies, but there's a lot of meaning making and understanding these relations, and how it makes a broader number and diversity of people actually mobilize and get with you when you have this sense of how connected these how deep the impacts of this infrastructure are in all lands and lives. And
That makes a lot of
Totally.
sense. It seems like pretty similar to the kinds of critiques that we made when we read this book as well, of it the title is How to Blow Up a Pipeline, but it is more like, why violence against objects should be seen as one aspect of the environmental movement when it's generally been stigmatized. And I think to your point, like it needs to be part of a broader collective struggle and conversation. Like we can't just like show up places and start blowing things up. Like that would not do much. And of course, always in conversation with the people whose lands we're on and who would be facing the direct impacts of those actions as well.
But I think these are really courageous conversations, and this is real core issues that need to be in conversations.
Yeah,
Yeah, well,
totally.
I'm glad we had this conversation today.
Thank you so
100%.
much.
Yeah, any last thoughts? I know we're kind of over time at this point, but really appreciate you coming to join us and sharing all of your wise insights.
Yeah, thank you so much for these, great and challenging questions. I think these are really important questions you raise, and I hope my responses help to just think about this and continue other conversations.
No, I'm very glad that we had you on, and very grateful for your contribution to the podcast.